Chapter 53. Swindling the coroner.
A great and priceless thing is a new interest. How it takes possession of a man, how it clings to him, how it rides him. I strode onward from the Schwerenbach Castellery a changed man, a reorganized personality. I walked into a new world, I saw with new eyes. I had been looking aloft at the giant show peaks only as things, to be worshipped for their grandeur and magnitude, and their unspeakable grace of form. I looked up at them now, as also things to be conquered and climbed. My sense of their grandeur and their noble beauty was neither lost nor impaired. I had gained a new interest in the mountains without losing the old ones. I followed the steep lines up, inch by inch, with my eye, and noted the possibility or impossibility of following them with my feet. When I saw a shining helmet of ice projecting above the clouds, I tried to imagine I saw files of black specks toiling up it rope together with a gossamer thread. We skirted the lonely little lake called the Dauben Sea, and presently passed close by a glacier on the right, a thing like a great river frozen solid in its flow, and broken square off like a wall at its mouth. I had never been so near a glacier before. Here we came upon a new board shanty, and found some men engaged in building a stone house, so the Schwerenbach was soon to have a rival. We bought a bottle or so of beer here. At any rate they called it beer, but I knew by the price that it was dissolved jewelry, and I perceived by the taste that dissolved jewelry is not good stuff to drink. We were surrounded by a hideous desolation. We stepped forward to a sort of jumping off place, and were confronted by a startling contrast. We seemed to look down into fairyland. 2,000 or 3,000 feet below us was a bright green level, with a pretty town in its midst, and a silvery stream winding among the meadows. The charming spot was walled in on all sides by gigantic precipices clothed with pines, and over the pines, out of the softened distances, rose the snowy domes and peaks of the Monte Rosa region. How exquisitely green and beautiful that little valley down there was! The distance was not great enough to obliterate details, it only made them little, and mellow, and dainty, like landscapes and towns seen through the wrong end of a spyglass. Right under us a narrow ledge rose up out of the valley, with a green, slanting, bench-shaped top, and grouped about upon this green base bench were a lot of black and white sheep which looked merely like oversized worms. The bench seemed lifted well up into our neighborhood. But that was a deception, it was a long way down to it. We began our descent now, by the most remarkable road I have ever seen. It wound its corkscrew curves down the face of the colossal precipice, a narrow way, with always the solid rock wall at one elbow, and perpendicular nothingness at the other. We met an everlasting procession of guides, porters, mules, litters, and tourists climbing up this steep and muddy path. And there was no room to spare when you had to pass a tolerably fat mule. I always took the inside when I heard or saw the mule coming and flattened myself against the wall. I preferred the inside, of course, but I should have had to take it anyhow because the mule prefers the outside. A mule's preference on a precipice is a thing to be respected. Well, his choice is always the outside. His life is mostly devoted to carrying bulky panniers and packages which rest against his body, therefore he is habituated to taking the outside edge of mountain paths to keep his bundles from rubbing against rocks or banks on the other. When he goes into the passenger business he absurdly clings to his old habit and keeps one leg of his passenger always dangling over the great deeps of the lower world, while that passenger's heart is in the highlands, so to speak. More than once I saw a mule's hind foot cave over the outer edge, and send earth and rubbish into the bottom abyss, and I noticed that upon these occasions the rider, whether male or female, looked tolerably unwell. There was one place, where an 18-inch breadth of light masonry had been added to the verge of the path, and as there was a very sharp turn here, a panel of fencing had been set up there at some time, as a protection. This panel was old, and gray and feeble, and the light masonry had been loosened by recent rains. A young American girl came along on a mule, and in making the turn the mule's hind foot caved all the loose masonry and one of the fence posts overboard. The mule gave a violent lurch inboard to save himself, and succeeded in the effort, but that girl turned as white as the snows of Mont Blanc for a moment. The path was simply a groove cut into the face of the precipice. There was a 4-foot breadth of solid rock under the traveler, and 4-foot breadth of solid rock just above his head, like the roof of a narrow porch. He could look out from this gallery, and see a sheer summitless and bottomless wall of rock before him, across a gorge or crack a biscuit's toss in width, but he could not see the bottom of his own precipice, unless he lay down, and projected his nose over the edge. I did not do this, because I did not wish to soil my clothes. Every few hundred yards, at particularly bad places, one came across a panel or so of plank fencing, but they were always old and weak, and they generally leaned out over the chasm, and did not make any rash promises to hold up people who might need support. There was one of these panels which had only its upper board left. A pedestrianizing English youth came tearing down the path, was seized with an impulse to look over the precipice, and without an instant's thought he threw his weight upon that crazy board. It bent outward a foot. I never made a gasp before that came so near suffocating me. The English youth's face simply showed a lively surprise, but nothing more. He went swinging along valleyward again, as if he did not know he had just swindled a coroner by the closest kind of a shave. The alpine litter is sometimes like a cushioned box made fast between the middles of two long poles, and sometimes it is a chair with a back to it, and a support for the feet. It is carried by relays of strong porters. The motion is easier than that of any other conveyance. We met a few men and a great many ladies in litters. It seemed to me that most of the ladies looked pale and nauseated. Their general aspect gave me the idea that they were patiently enduring a horrible suffering. As a rule, they looked at their laps and left the scenery to take care of itself. But the most frightened creature I saw was a led horse that overtook us. Poor fellow, he had been born and reared in the grassy levels of the Candlestick Valley, and had never seen anything like this hideous place before. Every few steps he would stop short, glance wildly out from the dizzy height, and then spread his red nostrils wide, and pant as violently as if he had been running a race, and all the while he quaked from head to heel, as with a palsy. He was a handsome fellow, and he made a fine statuesque picture of terror, but it was pitiful to see him suffer so. This dreadful path has had its tragedy. Baedeker, with his customary overterseness, begins and ends the tale thus. The descent on horseback should be avoided. In 1861 a Comtesse der Linkert fell from her saddle over the precipice, and was killed on the spot. We looked over the precipice there, and saw the monument which commemorates the event. It stands in the bottom of the gorge, in a place which has been hollowed out of the rock, to protect it from the torrent and the storms. Our old guide never spoke, but when spoken to, and then limited himself to a syllable or two, but when we asked him about this tragedy he showed a strong interest in the matter. He said the Countess was very pretty, and very young, hardly out of her girlhood, in fact. She was newly married, and was on her bridal tour. The young husband, and was riding a little in advance. One guide was leading the husband's horse, another was leading the bride's. The old man continued. The guide that was leading the husband's horse happened to glance back, and there was that poor young thing sitting up staring out over the precipice. And her face began to bend downward a little, and she put up her two hands slowly, and met it so, and put them flat against her eyes so, and then she sank out of the saddle, with a sharp shriek, and one caught only the flash of a dress, and it was all over. Then after a pause, ah, yes, that guide saw these things, yes, he saw them all. He saw them all, just as I have told you. After another pause, ah, yes, he saw them all. My God, that was me. I was that guide. This had been the one event of the old man's life, so one may be sure he had forgotten no detail connected with it. We listened to all he had to say about what was done, and what happened, and what was said after the sorrowful occurrence, and a painful story it was. When we had wound down toward the valley until we were about on the last spiral of the corkscrew, Harris's hat blew over the last remaining bit of precipice, a small cliff 100 or 150 feet high, and sailed down toward a steep slant composed of rough chips and fragments which the weather had flaked away from the precipices. We went leisurely down there, expecting to find it without any trouble, but we had made a mistake as to that. We hunted during a couple of hours, not because the old straw hat was valuable, but out of curiosity, to find out how such a thing could manage to conceal itself in open ground, where there was nothing left for it to hide behind. When one is reading in bed, and lays his paper knife down, he cannot find it again, if it is smaller than a saber. That hat was as stubborn as any paper knife could have been, and we finally had to give it up. But we found a fragment that had once belonged to an opera glass, and by digging around and turning over the rocks we gradually collected all the lenses, and the cylinders and the various odds and ends that go to making up a complete opera glass. We afterward had the thing reconstructed, and the owner can have his adventurous lost property by submitting proofs and paying costs of rehabilitation. We had hopes of finding the owner there, distributed around amongst the rocks, for it would have made an elegant paragraph. But we were disappointed. Still, we were far from being disheartened, for there was a considerable area which we had not thoroughly searched. We were satisfied he was there, somewhere, so we resolved to wait over a day at Luke, and come back and get him. Then we sat down to polish off the perspiration, and arrange about what we would do with him when we got him. Harris was for contributing him to the British Museum, but I was for mailing him to his widow. That is the difference between Harris and me. Harris is all for display, I am all for the simple right, even though I lose money by it. Harris argued in favor of his proposition against mine, I argued in favor of mine and against his. The discussion warmed into a dispute. The dispute warmed into a quarrel. I finally said, very decidedly, my mind is made up. He goes to the widow. Harris answered sharply, and my mind is made up. He goes to the museum. I said, calmly, the museum may whistle when it gets him. Harris retorted, the widow may save herself the trouble of whistling, for I will see that she never gets him. After some angry bandying of epithets, I said, it seems to me that you are taking on a good many airs about these remains. I don't quite see what you've got to say about them. I've got all to say about them. They'd never have been thought of if I hadn't found their opera glass. The corpse belongs to me, and I'll do as I please with him. I was leader of the expedition, and all discoveries achieved by it naturally belonged to me. I was entitled to these remains, and could have enforced my right, but rather than have bad blood about the matter, I said we would toss up for them. I threw heads and won, but it was a barren victory, for although we spent all the next day searching, we never found a bone. I cannot imagine what could ever have become of that fellow. The town in the valley is called Lucerbud. We pointed our course toward it, down a verdant slope which was adorned with fringed gentians and other flowers, and presently entered the narrow alleys of the outskirts, and waded toward the middle of the town through liquid fertilizer. They ought to either pave that village, or organize a ferry. Harris's body was simply a chamois pasture. His person was populous with the little hungry pests. His skin, when he stripped, was splotched like a scarlet fever patient's. So, when we were about to enter one of the Lucerbud inns, and he noticed its sign, Chamois Hotel, he refused to stop there. He said the chamois was plentiful enough, without hunting up hotels, where they made a specialty of it. I was indifferent, for the chamois is a creature that will neither bite me nor abide with me. But to calm Eris, we went to the O Caratel des Alps. At the table do Carati, we had this, for an incident. A very grave man, in fact his gravity amounted to solemnity, and almost to austerity sat opposite us, and he was tight, but doing his best to appear sober. He took up a cork bottle of wine, tilted it over his glass a while, then set it out of the way, with a contented look, and went on with his dinner. Presently he put his glass to his mouth, and of course found it empty. He looked puzzled, and glanced furtively and suspiciously out of the corner of his eye at a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.